Hostile forces inbound. Preparing RPG X-ray countermeasures. Evacuate to safe distance. Firing in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to RPG X-ray, the podcast that looks inside what makes RPGs tick. If you're a role-playing gamer that wants to think about the hidden systems inside the games we love to play, join us for a regular discussion of the theory and practice of tabletop roleplay. As a reminder, before we get rolling, please stay in touch with us and send in your own thoughts and questions. We're reachable via links on our website, RPG X-ray, or via our email, contact@rpgxray.com. This episode's topic is horror. Horror is one of the oldest RPG genres and has wrapped its tentacles around much of modern tabletop gameplay, but what is it? What makes an RPG horror in tone, mechanics, or gameplay? Are horror games scary? Should they be? Can they be? All this and more on this episode of RPG X-ray. Joining the X-Ray team today are Jason Beaumont, Brendan Power, Eric Saltwell, and myself, Ethan Schoonover. As always, before jumping into the main course, we like to start things off with an amuse-bouche we call Appendix X.
So in Appendix X, we do a little summary of all the media we're consuming currently, with a particular eye toward how it could be applied to gaming. I'll start off. I have been playing a game called Dave the Diver recently. Dave the Diver is a PC game, I think, only at this point. And you play as a man who's diving in a lagoon in a tropical location, finding fish, bringing it back up, and giving the fish to a local sushi restaurant. You then serve patrons at the sushi restaurant where you earn money, and then you could upgrade the sushi restaurant in your own equipment, your own scuba equipment. One of the things I think is cool about the game is it actually has a ton of heart. It's one of those games where you're introduced to characters and you think they're just kind of utility characters. They're there to sell you a piece of equipment or give you a quest. But over multiple hours, you really learn a lot about the individual characters and really delve into them. And I think that's something that we do a lot in tabletop RPGs that campaign play is especially good for. You meet a character, they seem like a minor character, and the recurrence of them allows you to kind of get into depth and a little bit more about what that character is and what their motivations are. And that's, I think, where some of our best tabletop RPG memories come from, are certain of those kind of recurring characters. Eric?
I feel like I played that game in college. I mean, I was a fry cook at Long John Silver's in college, so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the difference being you weren't probably catching the fish that you were serving.
And I didn't own the restaurant, that's for sure.
Right.
I'm incredibly disillusioned about Long John Silver's now. I thought you were out there with a rod and reel and.
Oh, no.
Okay. I have never been to a Long John Silver's in my life, but I am not even more compelled this time.
I lovingly remember the day that I got to upgrade my job and cut the slices of fish out of the big brick of frozen fish. So for my amuse-bouche today, I wanted to talk about an actual play that I'm listening to. And I just want to say that this is a totally unsponsored plug. I have been listening to the actual play of the God's Teeth campaign by Caleb Stokes in his Patreon, Delta Green Dead Channels. And it is just sublime. It is superb. It is amongst the best scenarios I've seen in, I don't know, since I've been playing maybe.
Very cool. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that? Or
yeah, so Delta Green, I think appropriate to today's topic, it's a horror game. Delta Green's a horror game, or close to it, somewhere between horror and thriller. And the God's Teeth campaign is a decade-spanning modern era horror, which has some slight Lovecraftian overtones, but is, is very not in your face about it and really puts an emphasis on the human horror and is just amazing.
Having read the pre-release versions of the campaign that have been published, I will say it is extremely grim and very graphic. So,
yeah, it is definitely capital H horror.
Yes. I have been reconsuming Gravity Falls, the cartoon that was on, I think Disney XD, Disney, the Disney Channel, I don't know, for a couple of years and is now, on, Disney Plus. with my younger kid. It is, you know, set in, I think, Oregon at some kind of roadside curio amusement stand where twin siblings encounter who are sort of forced, obligated to spend the summer with their great uncle, their grunkle. I think they encounter all sorts of weird cryptids throughout the course of the series. And there's a sort of meta plot that ties into, you know, ultimately them saving the universe, I suppose. But, you know, it's useful in terms of, you know, gaming in a variety of ways. And that, if, you know, first of all, it delves into sort of all the, you know, stories about, you know, Bigfoot and, you know, wild gnomes and things that that you need to work into various, you know, fantastical or horror games. But it also does this really good job of mixing tone between comic and horror. And it does achieve below the ladder, even though it is, of course, primarily aimed at young adults. But it's fantastic.
I absolutely second that. It is fantastic. That is one of my favorite cartoons. My kids and incredible. We will regularly have kind of like trivia, you know, trivia offs, I guess, where we like quiz each other on like what happened on, you know, season one and, you know, what's the name of so-and-so. And it's great. I love that. It's such a shame that it was canceled.
No, I know. I mean, it makes you want to delve into, of course, the process by which it got approved in the first place. Like, what was the pitch that where Disney was like, yes, this is what we want, because it seems implausible. But yeah, it's fantastic.
Have you guys read the physical journal that they sell at the bookstores?
Yes, yeah. all the various side projects that they've fleshed out. Yeah, that's all great.
Yeah. So I'll pick that thread up because it leads into what I did this summer, which was drive 5,000 miles. And the first stop along the way, this was across, you know, from Washington State in United States. Yeah, it was horrific, but also great. But the very first stop that my son and I made, because it was just my son and I on the way out, and then on the way back, it was the whole family. But the first stop we made was actually at a little place along the highway in Washington State that basically looks like the Mystery Shack from Gravity Falls. And we were very excited about that. But over the course of our road trip, we listened to several audiobooks. And we started off with the Laundry Files. This was all re-listen for me. It was all new to my son. And he was like, whoa, what is this? Laundry Files by Charlie Strauss. And then I followed that up with a book called The Rook by Daniel O'Malley is his name. So I really, if you haven't listened to the Laundry Files, they're great. It's kind of mandatory listening if you're into Lovecraftian horror and you like English bureaucracy. The same with The Rook. This is like, you know, if MI6 met Lovecraft and, or MI5, I can never keep them straight. We'll go with MI5.5. But if English bureaucracy met like, you know, the horrors of the dark and the supernatural, that's what The Rook is, and largely what The Laundry Files is as well. So loved both those books. They absolutely stand up for repeated listenings, these audiobooks or repeated readings. So check them out.
All right, well, let's get started with today's topic. Today's topic is horror gaming. And as we usually do, we'll start by defining our terms, eating our vegetables. The question today is, what is horror gaming? What makes a game a horror game versus a thriller versus an adventure game? Brendan, why don't you start us off?
Sure. Well, you know, I guess, you know, I think that the most important element of a horror game is some sort of, you know, generating some sort of fear of the unknown, right? I mean, horror movies are distinguished from thriller movies in that, you know, there's maybe not a clean cut explanation for the terrible things that happen. I mean, in your average action movie, you know, you can draw a pretty clear through line from, you know, bad person doing something bad to, you know, your protagonist or hero, you know, resolving things. Whereas in a horror movie, it's a little more mysterious and, you know, misunderstood, I suppose. And so, you know, I think that there's an element of confusion or opacity that has to exist for a horror game to be successful. And, you know, as we alluded to in the intro, I think the, you know, Call of Cthulhu is obviously the first and most important horror RPG deck in the early days alongside D&D. I think ably introduced, you know, reintroduced the world back to Lovecraft, who have, of course, had sort of mastered the premise that, there are things that, you know, mankind is too weak to understand.
Jason, how about you? How would you define horror gaming?
I'm going to kind of ask some questions to work the edges on where we think our definition is on it. Monster of the Week. Like, do we view that as a horror RPG?
I do not, I think. Sorry, and I should back up for a second and say my view of horror is that it is not principally a role-playing game that is scary. That is, there are scary games, and certainly there is an extent to which that is, like, horrific, and that is horror. But when you think about horror games as a genre, it is actually, to me, the opposite of agency. That when you're playing an action game, an adventure game, a thriller, where if you look at, like, Knight's Black Agents, which as a thriller is very, you know, can be very scary, the difference is when I'm playing in an adventure game or a thriller, I am trying to overcome the challenge that is presented in the game. If that's some Lovecraftian horror or it's some human beings doing terrible stuff. But in a horror game like Aliens, which we're playing with Brendan, or Purist Gumshoe, like Very Pure Gumshoe, Trail of Cthulhu, I feel like that's really not the goal. That's not what you should try to do, because really the game is set up so that you can't win that's not the goal. That's not how you're supposed to play. You're not trying to beat the Lovecraftian horror in Purist Trail of Cthulhu. And so to me, it's all about that in a horror game. You're not trying to overcome a challenge. You're just trying to experience the demise. And for me, that's why I would say that Monster of the Week is an adventure game.
And so, like, I'm going to keep pressing on you with questions to work your definition a bit. So My Life with Master, which is, you know, an indie RPG where you are playing the minions of, like, an evil, like, you know, overlord. Would you view something like that as a horror game, or is it more up to the scenario?
I mean, so in Life with Master, I feel like the scenario is much more embedded into the game, right? It's less of a system and more of a game where the level design is built in. But I would say that for me, Life with Master is a horror game.
Okay, and that's because why?
It's because you really, the game is not, if you look at the mechanics, if you look at the scenario, it is not about... I mean, I don't think, I've actually never played Life with Master, but my understanding of it is that it is not about, hey, how do you get free from the yoke of Master, right? It is really about the horror of having to live with that and not being able to overcome it. It's this thing that you you can't overcome. And so that's not what you want to experience in the game.
So you don't have agency, right? So that lack of player agency is, like, a key ingredient.
Yeah, absolutely. You. Yes. Yeah. And because to me, that's intricately tied with, what am I trying to do? Am I trying to overcome a challenge, or am I trying to experience my failure to overcome a challenge?
Yeah. And to me, like, that's, I was, because I knew this question was going to come up. One of the things that I would say, just as a game master, that I have experienced running horror games is that the players are really bought in to wanting to experience horror, usually. Like, they've joined the game because they actually want that lack of agency. Like, they want a bad thing to happen to their character. They get disappointed if you play a Call of Cthulhu session and, like, you're not rolling sanity rolls enough. Like, they're kind of bummed that their character didn't have some sort of dramatic sanity losing moment or some, you know, moment of complete cosmic terror. And so I think that there is an important part of the genre where players are like, yeah, I just want to experience, like, my character having something terrible happen to them. And that's, like, where I'm going to get pleasure out of this session.
I mean, I do, you know, Eric, to your point earlier, I do think that helplessness is, you know, often an interesting component of horror content, horror games, horror movies, et cetera. And I don't know that I think it's mandatory, like or required to a social worker? I mean, I guess, you know, I think for me, you know, you alluded to God's Teeth earlier, which has truly a bunch of sort of horrifying representations of human behavior in service of, you know, some ineffable power, essentially. And those things are horrific in part because they, you know, take place prior to the characters becoming involved. And, you know, the implication is that, you know, there's been, you know, terrible abuse of humans for, you know, many years leading up into the events of the game. And that itself is, you know, the sort of undertone that you know, guides the entire campaign going forward. And, you know, I think that is horrific, but it's sort of a background horror to, you know, the, like, what's rampaging through the bushes or in the nearby woods, and how can I address and stop it? I mean, I think that there's a component of, like, you know, obviously horror games are most successful, I think, when players have the ability to imagine for themselves, you know, like to assemble the details that they've learned throughout the course of the game, and then, you know, concoct for themselves the actual, you know, horror in their own minds. You know, obviously many people are afraid of being helpless and being powerless, you know, unable to control their destinies. So,
well, so to explore that a little bit, like, let's use Curse of Strahd as an example. Curse of Strahd's maybe the most played horror RPG scenario, like, of all time, right? And that, I would say, thematically is about the player characters trying to become lights in the darkness, trying to actually bring some sort of hope to, like, a doomed land. Would that fit your definition of horror still, Eric?
No, because Curse of Strahd, while it is scary and has tones and themes of horror, which, I mean, like, yes, there is a common day, everyday sense of the term horror, in which, of course, Curse of Strahd is a horror-toned, horror-themed game. But in terms of being a horror RPG, I don't think so, because, like, the goal is to defeat Strahd, and you're trying to do it, and you are given the tools that make it possible. And so, to me, that's an action game. I think really telling here is, for some of the really horror games, like Trail of Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu, there are these two ways that you can play both of these games. There is purist and pulpy. And I would say purist is supposed to be the most horror of the horror, and pulpy is supposed to be the more adventure-y, action-y. And really the only, because you could play any of these scenarios either way, kind of. And the difference is, am I playing to overcome the challenge in the horror, or am I playing to experience it?
Yeah, I like that term that you just used, which was horror themed versus horror.
Yeah,
I think that to me is like the crux of it, that we have a lot of horror themed games that get called horror games that are not horror games. I mean, it's like movies, right? Or TV shows. I mean, the scariest TV show that I've watched in recent memory is Severance. I don't know how many of you have seen this.
I have not.
It's on Apple TV. It's a workplace show, workplace TV show, much like The Office in tone. No, not really. I mean, there are very funny moments in it, and it's very grim, and it's about being very powerless and having put yourself in that situation. I don't want to say anything else.
That's how I was with God's Teeth. I was like, okay, I don't want to describe it because I don't want to give away any spoilers.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
But then, like, even like the scariest movie I've seen recently, it probably was, for me at least personally, was Nope, right, by Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
And that movie is on, you know, in terms of like the themes, the visual themes, there's, you know, it's beautiful and sunny and bright and open vistas. It's not what I would call like traditional horror themes. You know, it's not like dark cramped alleys.
Haunted houses.
You know, yeah. You don't the typical tropes where you, like, you lack vantage, you can't see, you can't perceive. That's all missing. It's all like, oh no, you can absolutely see what's coming, and it's terrifying. Like, you know, that's the only movie I've had nightmares about, like, after having seen it recently, like as a grown up, that I can remember, like, horror film. But I'm trying to think about, like, what other games have we played or you played or any of us that are that have scared us that are not games that we would call horror games per se?
So I definitely have played a bunch of 5e that was played and was intended to be and was, I think, was scary. And that's just purely about the scenario design. And but it was scary. It was not. I don't know if it was if it was horror in the sense that the kind of technical term that I was using.
I mean, do you really mean scary in that people were anxious or worried about the content of the game, or do you mean more creepy? I guess I sort of challenge the idea that any of these games can truly be scary in the sense that obviously we're all sitting around a well-lit table with beverages and cracking jokes in between sessions, and I think it's hard to truly be scary in any of these cases.
Yes, let's come back to that actually in terms of like atmospherics. I'd like to put a pin in that because I think we can actually explore whether or not a game can be scary. But okay, what was the other term you used?
Creepy.
Not scary, but creepy. That's a better distinction.
And I think Brendan, just to answer your question, I think it was more creepy, right?
Okay.
It was much more horror themed and people were creeped out more than actually scared.
I've definitely experienced creepiness more often in a tabletop RPG than actual horror and fear.
Okay, so. Now what about something like a movie? Have you experienced something that really scared you in a movie?
Yeah, for sure. I would say movies and video games definitely have a much more profound emotional effect on me. And I think, it's also probably the case that when I'm playing RPGs, a majority of the time I'm the game master. And so, like, I don't get to kind of, like, go along for the ride because I know what's behind all the doors, you know? So that, I think, maybe limits my experience. I would say Eric runs a once-a-year Halloween dread session where we use Jenga and, play out a horror scenario. And I would say I have experienced really deep feelings of tension and worry and anxiety during those games. And they're not just because of the scenario. They're also just because of the mechanics.
The physicality of the Jenga set.
Totally. I think it makes a huge difference. Yeah. I didn't expect that before I played it. I was like, whatever, this is going to be stupid and like a gimmick. And it's not at all. It's like, in fact, it's maybe one of the most effective mechanisms for creating like real tension at the table.
Yeah. And I think that's both the aesthetics of the physicality of it, and it's also the fact that you know that every time you play a Jenga piece, you know that mechanically things get harder every time,
right?
And more and more tense. I'm very interested to play 10 Candles, which also has some physicality in that you light 10 physical candles, and as those candles burn out in the session, in the real world, the game gets harder and closer to disaster. And you know that eventually all those candles will burn out and the characters will meet a horrible fate.
Okay. So I'd said that I'd wanted to put a pin in atmospherics, but I feel like this actually, there's in the Venn diagram of atmospherics and like physical props, there's a big overlap. And so let's come back to that now. I think about dread all the time in regards to horror at the table, because I feel like that the physicality of it obviously is really key. You have a Jenga tower, you're pulling out Jenga blocks at key moments, with the inevitable result that the tower will fall. And when you play Jenga, you can replay Jenga, right? You can replay Jenga even though you know that the tower will fall. Because there's tension that builds, and then it falls down, and you can play Dread for the same reason. And the trick of Dread is that it taps into that physical, that your limbic system somehow, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? There's just that kind of primal or like childhood or physical fear of something falling and shattering on the table.
So the last time that we played Dread, and I think you were not there, Ethan. We
it was too
also
much, too much for me, Eric.
We in an attempt to extend that moment of tension and anxiety, right? Like what I really love about Dread is when the tower gets really, really unstable and people have to pull it and it's just so fraught. And in an attempt to extend that, I added a mechanic where you could, where there were four cards face down on the table. And if the tower got really bad, you could choose to draw a card, and one of those four cards face down was the death card, and it's the same as if your tower gets knocked down. And when somebody draws a card, now there's only three cards there if they didn't draw the death card. And Jason, I think, as somebody who was at the game, I wanted to ask, like, do you feel like there was a difference between when you decided to draw from the tower and you had that real physicality of the tower being precarious versus when we drew, when you would go to the card?
I'll tell you the answer I was going to say, and I don't think it's correct, which was that I knew when drawing from the tower, I was kind of affecting the entire table.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that was also true for the cards as well, right? There were only so many, like it was a shared pool of cards that the table was drawing from too. So for both mechanics, you were kind of dooming the group with your action as well. I will say that the card is like you're leaving things up to luck. And with Jenga, you at least think you have some sort of skill that can allow you to get through it. And I know that I'm not a great Jenga player. Like I remember the first time we played Dread, afterwards, Eric said, yeah, you pulled the very first, block, Jason. And you did it the exact wrong way. You did it like in a way that like doomed the entire tower for the entire game. Right.
Yep.
And that always kind of stuck with me. Where it was like, man, I need to go learn the actual Jenga strategy because whatever we were doing was not So I guess the card a little bit more.
Doesn't like being an expert in Jenga, having not played Dread, I don't totally understand how the mechanics work. But I mean, if everyone at the table were a world champion Jenga player, would that make the game? The game would not be horrific, right?
You're right. No, it would extend the scenario. You would be like, I'm just going to leap off this building. I'm going to be fine because I know how to pull the exact right, but the reality is nobody is good at Jenga, it seems like, at least, that we were playing with. And the entire tower was just an architectural disaster within two or three choices, that the players are making.
Yeah, if everybody's a Jenga expert, then it turns into the horror. It's like Scream, right? Everybody in that movie knows the rules of horror movies, but they still are subject to the rules of horror movies.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I think it's interesting. I mean, thinking about Ethan, you're talking about atmospherics. I mean, I guess there's like when running a game, there's both, an RPG has both a tone to it and also a set of mechanics that relate to how the game is, administered or adjudicated or whatever. And you want both of those things to be aligned to produce, like in Dread, to produce the best possible result. Or Dread, you've obviously got this ambiguous outcome of whether the tower will survive or not. But like, flashing back to the Curse of Strahd reference earlier, I mean, I think D&D specifically, like you can write a D&D adventure with the tone of a gothic horror like Curse of Strahd, but mechanically D&D is still the same power fantasy it's always been, with levels and new feats and whatever, and that in that case I think it's unsuccessful at being horrific for me because it does not have the game mechanically does not support the tone that you're trying to run it within without grafting on a bunch of stuff. But I mean, still fundamentally it's D&D under the covers.
Okay. I just want to keep this brief, but it makes me think about the origin of so many monsters in D&D, which are things like Grimm's Fairy Tales. And, if you've ever read those, some of them are really quite terrifying, actually, to read to children.
I mean, because they're all about eating children.
They're all about eating children and like the monster, like very scary things, the things that truly scare children, right? Like grown-ups being untrustworthy and horrific and all that kind of stuff, or creepy monsters that truly are just absolutely like teeth gnashing and terrifying. And all those things have kind of been, woven into our like mythology or like our, this broad pan mythology that we have kind of subsumed into role-playing games like D&D. And we've kind of defanged them in a way because we've turned them into stat blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though they have their origin in these like scary stories, like D&D, like if you met an orc in real life, it'd be terrifying at night. But if you meet an orc in D&D, it's just one more, statistical obstacle to overcome.
Right.
I mean, I think that's true of Call of Cthulhu as well, because all of the sort of, you know, the typical of crafting creatures are all so well understood after 40 years of, you know, games set in that universe that it just becomes a matter of pattern matching of like, oh, I feel tired and the color is draining out of my environment. Well, that's a color out of space, obviously. Yeah, and various authors, including Nobody Ken Hyde, have sort of tried to come up with new ways for the classic Lovecraftian monsters to be rejuvenated in terms of, you know, how they're portrayed or their effects. But nonetheless,
Would you say even reanimated?
yes, I would say reanimated. But I do think it's like the reason that God's Teeth is effective is that it does not rest on classic horror tropes of Lovecraftian monsters. Instead, just devises horrific human things that would terrify anybody and is untethered from the actual great old one, essentially sitting behind the scenes. But yeah, it's absolutely I agree.
I think that's a good point. Ethan, just to come back to what you were talking about with atmospherics, do you think that that's why movies are so much better at creating real scariness and fear in people in a way that games can't, is because the visual nature of the medium and the deep atmospherics and the sound is just better able to do that limbic system activation?
Yeah. I really do. I think that the sitting in the dark, which is, the optimal viewing situation, right? Say my daughter and I often will watch horror movies and we have a term, which is, whether or not evaluate if the movie is turn the lights on scary. Like, is it so scary you have to turn the lights on afterwards? And there's very few movies really that are like that for me, at least today. Like when I was a kid, maybe, but for me, it's like basically like ghost movies and alien abduction movies, like 100% turn the lights on scary for me. And I was trying to think, actually before we came into this podcast, I was like, if we did a ghost, could you do a ghost RPG that really felt turn the lights on scary, or like an alien abduction RPG that felt, like made me feel like something was in the corner of the room.
Yep.
And I think maybe you could, if you played it right. It would be, you'd have to be, I think, quite skilled as a game master to do it, but I'm kind of keen to try that now.
Absolutely. For me, that's Arachnophobia, the movie that was like, I watched it in college with my roommate, and it was like late at night and we literally had to turn the lights on. It was
clicking my pen and taking a note.
Exactly. So I feel like I try really hard to build those atmospherics. I'm planning a dread scenario that involves being stuck on the open ocean and like recording wave sounds and trying to play them. Or we had in one of our dread scenarios an evil thing that smelled like sugar cookies, and I tried actually melting wax in and putting sugar cookies in the wax and then having like an incense burner thing that would heat up the wax while we were in the room so everybody could smell the sugar cookie, which is just supposed to be a contrast with the horror of the thing.
Yeah, and again, did all this in my basement, by the way.
Yeah, I'd like to, as an aside, let's just, for the listeners at home, we have to mention how often Eric's scenarios involve substances. Like, I mean physical substances, and also quite often Jason's basement. So yes.
Yeah. But I still find it super hard to create that so much atmospherics that you are transported into the character in the way that you are in a movie, so that even though you know that you're safe at your movie seat, you still feel that fear. And there's just, I don't know, do you guys think there's just too much of a divide there and it's something we shouldn't try to overcome and we just accept creepiness?
Okay, if you didn't tell your standard party of D&D murder hobos that you were going to play a horror game and you just like rolled up as the game master and started running a totally different rule set or scenario or what have you, I think that their response would be to just, gleefully and joyfully with humor, try to kill everything, because that's sort of the standard D&D murder hobo modality.
Yep.
Right. And it would destroy the experience, I think, or at least it would destroy it for the game master, who was very excited to run a scary or horror themed game. And I think that despite our best intent of buy-in with horror games, quite often it's easy to revert back to kind of humor And you know, and whether or not that starts as like nervous laughter, and then you try to diffuse that nervous laughter just because we're human beings that do that type of thing. I feel like at the table, it is really hard to corral that dynamic that sort of develops among the players. And it's, if we can figure out a way to do that, I think that you can create a truly scary, terrifying scenario. How you guide people through that, I think, is the other question as well, like safely guide them through.
Sorry, this is to say, Brendan, about I feel like you suffer through the fact that I am very bad at this as a player. I feel like when we've played Aliens and I try to play a horror scenario and embody the horror, I find myself getting off track and off rail, even unintentionally, all the time. So, for example, I was playing in Aliens, I was playing a mechanic effectively and has an agenda item to that they need money, right? And this kind of made in the Aliens game, I'm like looking through the ship trying to find money, embody my character, but it became almost, you know, almost became more comedic in that you know, that this character is being kind of money grubbing and, you know, is in this scary scenario but is focused on this like, oh, I gotta go raid the starship or whatever it is. I feel like I have a really hard time with staying in that moment that you're talking about, Ethan.
Obviously, the purpose of the agendas in an Alien game is to ensure that the characters have a reason to not, you know, buck the intent of the scenario, right? You know, no one wants to watch a movie where everyone just decides to stay in their own spaceship. They want to see where things go when you come across another one. But yeah, I mean, I think that there is that, Ethan, you're right. Obviously, you know, typically the D&D mentality is, you know, like in the recent D&D movie, cracking jokes and smashing heads, and that is, you know, the thing that people are bought into. Sitting around a table with a group of friends, you are always going to want to joke and you know, just enjoy your time and people, irrespective of the game being played. I guess I think, you know, the part of the sort of initial buy-in of a horror game for me is that, you know, trying to minimize to some extent out of character joking around the table, like in character, like, you know, joking within the context of the game makes total sense to me, because you think about, you know, the Scream movies, which of course remain horror despite having, you know, a joke every 20 seconds, or, you know, like there are moments of levity in the Alien movies, for example, where characters are joking amongst themselves about the context or the content inside the world of the movie. And I think that, you know, getting too far away from the table tone with, you know, out of character comments is the kind of thing where I think that, you know, lessens the impact of the potential impact of the game.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think that table talk and that type of and any kind of metagame atmospherics hugely impacted. It's why one of the reasons why I think it'd be very hard to play a true horror game with kids. I think you could play a scary game with kids.
I would definitely be down for game mastering a creepy game with kids. Do I want nihilism to be introduced to their lives at that age? Probably not. You know, I think there's probably other fun things we could do with our time together, but teaching them, here's a game you can play where the inevitable outcome is doom. I'm not sure like that's a concept to rush into. They'll have plenty of their lives to experience that. So, I could definitely see doing a Monster of the Week kind of thing, you know. And actually just yesterday, my kids and I were playing Atlas Games as Magical Kitty Save the Day.
Yep.
And part of the challenge they had to face were these phantasmal wolves, like these ghost wolves that are in a setting that I believe Jason Alexander of the Alexandrian fame wrote for it, which is kind of like a fairy tale world. And that's where their cats live. But these phantasmal wolves were an opportunity to kind of have something creepy, you know, in the game. And they got genuinely spooked by the characters. But in no way was it going to end with, like, you know, or like a Robert Schwab, like, you know, Demon Lord kind of setting where it's like, now the phantasmal wolves have taken over Snow White's, you know, realm and now all the humans are dead, right? Like, that's just not, you know, a thing I think you run with kids. So
that's I'm curious, though. So with those phantasmal wolves that they were kind of creeped out by, scared by, was there kind of like a frisson of fear? Was it something where they were like, this is like they were both scared but drawn to it or wanted more of it? Or was it just scary, like, ooh, get those away?
It was more like that. And I think I experienced something that you experienced multiple times running the D&D club for kids that you ran, Ethan, which is their solution was to become friends with the wolves. Like, that's like, you know, it's one of the wonderful things about kids' minds is that that's where their solutions go to, right? Which, yeah, I don't think really jives super well with horror. Like, I don't think, you know, you definitely want to become friends with, you know, an elder god. Probably not a great long-term
plan. This is not
plan.
Monsters, Inc., people.
Right, right.
I'd like to just propose category refinement, I guess.
Great.
And that would be that there are no horror games, or there are horror games, but they are one very tight, small subset. There's a lot of horror themed gaming.
Yep.
You might even put D&D in that category.
Yep. It's, right. I think it certainly can be.
And you're distinguishing between horror and horror themed in what way? What is the year?
Okay. So Call of Cthulhu, I kind of almost don't think is a horror game for the most part.
I'm on the same page with you, by the way, Ethan, about this.
These are maybe not the best terms. We can workshop them, but I would say that there are games that are tension games, and there's overlap between all these. This is like big Venn diagram territory, okay? Tension, there are scary games that have scares or maybe even jump scares. I'm not sure. That can definitely happen in gaming. And then there's horror games that are horrific, right? And that's the category. I think that when we talk about horror gaming, I think a lot of us, when we think of the indie games that we've played, we think about these because they are things like nihilism, the inevitable deterioration, lack of agency. And that's horror in sort of a deep and very kind of adult way.
So when I think about this lack of agency and that really horrific, the thing that comes to my mind is, Brendan, I don't remember the name of this campaign. It's a collection of super purist Trail of Cthulhu adventures that you turned me onto, and then I ran for Ethan and for, actually, you played in a game. Do you remember what it was called?
Yeah, that was Graham Walmsley's campaign for Trail of Cthulhu. It's the collective version is called The Final Revelation, I think.
Yeah, The Final Revelation. That's right. So I want to ask, because I often, like, I've run a ton of horror games. I've run Dread. I've run this purist Trail of Cthulhu. But I often have a very hard time with it about, like, is this really working as an RPG? Because, like, is this just me? Often these horror scenarios are also very linear or railroady because you often know what the horror is. And if the characters are the ones making the horror, I often find that it's not scary. Am I just saying a play and then people are kind of improvising in my story? Or, you know, what is the player trying to do here? And I don't know, Ethan, maybe as somebody who played in that purist game, you can tell me what your thoughts are here.
I definitely feel like that a lot of the time with Gumshoe games in general, but let me think about that for a second. Anybody else have any comments?
I mean, Brendan, I know you've played in this. Yeah. And clearly, you've definitely read a ton of purist Trail of Cthulhu.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, I think Fate sort of famously, one of the scenarios in that campaign has no combat at all, nothing to actually fight. And I think that, you know, there's just sort of this, it is a little railroady in that there is a conclusion to be had, but I think it's probably relatively unsatisfying for players who are unfamiliar with the tropes of Lovecraft's written work, certainly. And I think you know, those purist adventures do have grim outcomes that are tonally appropriate and are, I think, you know, to my mind, horrific because of the way that each of the conclusions of those adventures sort of it does. They certainly do subvert player control and player agency to some extent, and I think that's where a lot of the horror comes from. Ultimately, there's essentially nothing to be done in certain scenarios or other ones where the players find out that their own actions were, you know, out of their own control, their complete control, and those things are all, you know, I'm warming to your idea that for a game to be a true horror game, there has to be some lack of control or helplessness that is attached to it.
Okay. Just a moment there, though. So I think that unlocked something for me.
It unlocked my heart. No, so it unlocked the idea that when you're playing a game, a gumshoe game like that, where you're a little bit on rails, I think all gumshoe systems kind of, all gumshoe system games kind of suffer from this in a way, which is like you end up, or you can end up with a very kind of on rails, you know, scene by scene experience. I think that in that situation, it doesn't feel too like, I don't, okay, if we were playing a game of gumshoe, it's not a horror themed game, and it was still kind of that on rails experience where you're going from scene to scene, it doesn't seem to be fundamentally different if it's a horror theme or not, or a horror game or not. And there is a lack of agency in those scenarios, in the sense that, you know, you're kind of progressing through this story structure, but you're doing it in a way which is sort of like playing jazz. Like, you're riffing. So Brendan, when you said like that, you have to be familiar with those tropes, I think that's really key, right? You need the group that you're playing with to be familiar with those tropes in order to successfully improv through them. And the joy and the fun of the game is watching each other build on those tropes and build on the narrative points in the game. Like, we may know where the song is ending, right? But the way that we get there, and the riffs and the solos, the right, like the drum solo, like all that stuff that happens during the game is watching somebody really express their kind of deep understanding of narrative structures in a beautiful and fun and interactive way, in the way that a good jazz band kind of does it. That's like a lack of agency, but it's, I mean, is jazz a lack of agency? Like, there's a structure to songs, but then there's also the improvising and the riffing and things like that.
I think I agree with you that there is a relationship there with jazz. I think when I hear you say that, what I hear is there's room for agency, but only like at a much smaller scale, right? In terms of like, well, what I do within a scene or how I try to get the clue, that's all different. You know, that's my agency. Even if ultimately that's not going to impact the large story, the story, it still gives me some freedom to be my character and to decide how I express that, even if it's not going to change the story as a whole.
I do think one difference, though, is a common trope in horror games is that you're going to have a couple of survivors. And I think the decisions of the players, like the survivors, aren't predetermined, I would say, in a scenario, right? And I think a difference between improv and music, or what happens at the table in a horror game, is I think you really don't know the outcome of a good horror tabletop RPG session. Whereas I think you do know the outcome of a song, usually, right? And you know you're going to do a structure in a certain way, and it ends in a certain way. You know what I liked about, I'll go back to Eric's dread session with the cookies and stuff, my character was one of the survivors of that. I definitely wasn't playing it thinking he was going to be a survivor. I was playing the character, and I was like, I'm just going to play out the cards and see how this one, how it forms, right, as it goes. And I think we ended it with a pretty surprising outcome in that session, where myself and one other character survived. And if I were to take bets at the beginning, that's not who I would have bet from just a character perspective.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of playing chess, like in an end. Like if you imagine playing chess and you start off the game of chess and you're missing half your pieces, but your opponent has all their pieces. That right. To me is sort of like, that's a horror scenario.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Right?
There's a chance you could win.
Yeah,
but your experience is going to be this like game of attrition, right? Where you're going to be losing pieces from the start, right? And it's your avenues of success are going to be whittled down from a million on the first move to, you know, 1,000 on the second move to a couple hundred. And then like you're like down to single digits pretty quick, but there's still a chance.
So right. What is the fun in it? I'm not saying it isn't fun. I'm just trying to do an analysis here. What do you think is it that's fun about, like, let's assume that you probably, you know, you're not Garry Kasparov, so you're in this situation, which means you're probably going to lose, almost certainly going to lose. What is the fun that people have when they play that? Like, is it just the pleasure of losing? Is it that I'm actually trying to win and likely to be disappointed at the end when I'm unhappy? Like, what is my mindset there? I This is what I have trouble with in all of these horror games.
I think it's exploring the permutations, like watching, like, oh, look at this beautiful, you know, this is different than the last time that we, even if you're losing, right? Yep. This is different than the last time I lost. Like, oh, now I'm losing, you know, I have my queen and my rook and the king over there in the corner. Last time it was, you know, five pawns. This is a totally different experience, and it's kind of beautiful to watch how that plays out. And then maybe you do win every once in a while. I think if you didn't win at all, ever, if there was never an avenue for success, it wouldn't be fun.
Yep, I agree with you. I think it's some kind of tension, like with the horror games that I run, if that's Psyrun or Dread or whatever, I feel like I definitely try myself to, you know, have it not be a total party kill every time for that reason. But I also always feel like I'm cheating when I do that, because I feel like I'm making it more thriller and less horror.
Okay, but right. Let's go back to the game Desperation that we all played, yeah, from Bully Pulpit Games, which is card based. And the narrative in that, it's a horror game for sure. I would say like 1800s, yeah, late 1800s,
in Kansas,
small, yeah, small town, like a settlement, and the interactions between these individuals, and the outcome is predetermined.
Predetermined in that there's a deck, yep, of cards that you have to flip and have to assign to different characters within the game, the context of the game village.
Well, okay. Are we at risk of spoilers? Fast forward 60 seconds if you want to play Desperation, you know, without right, any awareness of it. But is it predetermined that everybody
No,
dies?
It's not. It's, you know, there are multiple phases of the game, and you take a subset of the cards for each playthrough, randomize them, and then the triggers to move from one phase to the other are also randomized. I mean, that's a, you know, so no, not okay, everybody is guaranteed to die, but certainly most people will die.
That's actually a tighter correlation to the chess analogy. In that,
yeah, I think, you know, games like Desperation, and actually Desperation has a second scenario we have actually not played together, which is about a cod skinner off the coast of Alaska in the same era. You know, those games, I think, are really successful horror because the mechanics are derived or designed rather to evoke that sense of dread where you're feeling, you're anticipating, you know, that some number of characters are not going to make it, and that they will have to endure these sort of like miniature terror arcs themselves as you lay down cards and impact the characters' lives. And I also think, yeah, I mean, one question I was going to leave to you guys is whether Monsignor 1244 is a horror game, because there's a game where, yeah, you know, we discussed in an earlier episode, I think, but the premise is that the religious sect within, you know, France is being besieged by, you know, people who want them to repent or die, and that, you know, like mechanically going into the game, everyone knows that the outcome of the game is going to be that all the characters save one will either have to reject their faith or die, and that is, you know, you have that choice for your character at the conclusion, but otherwise, you know, the sort of knowledge that everyone's fate is almost certainly doomed, I think for me does make that a horror game, and I think it's because of that sort of mechanical constraint that, you know, not everyone can win. I don't know. What do you guys think?
It's a great example of a horror game, I think. Yeah, I think it fits the definition, the frame that Eric laid out, and now that you, I don't know if I would have described it as a horror game before this session, so... But now I would.
So what if I had a game of, let's say, 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons, right? And it was fantasy adventure themed, right? It's orcs and nothing surprising, you know, all the stat blocks. But every round, every roll has an additional minus one to it. So your first action in the game is minus one, then minus two, then minus three. Like, this is a game you're going to fail, and your characters, if they do anything, will end up with a TPK. Is this a game now that is not horror themed and not scary, but we would say is still horror because of the fact that you can't really play it to overcome the challenge?
It feels more like a game where you're optimizing based on the limited moves that you have than a horror game. Like, I feel like I would treat a game like that, like a limited resource board game or video game, more than I would say it's a horror RPG that I'm playing.
Yeah, there's something, I mean, it's certainly, you're headed in the right direction, I think, Eric, but yep, I feel like there needs to be, first of all, there has to be, I think, some surprise or randomness. Like, it's okay to know that the Jenga tower is going to fall. We know that.
Yep.
But when that happens is really like there's an element of our control.
Yep.
Or at least the illusion of control. And the time that it happens is indeterminate, although inevitable. And I think that if you have a mechanic which is determinate and inevitable, like then it's less scary, right? Then it's then it is tactics. Then you're playing a tactical game.
So is this about the necessity of tension? Is that what you all of a sudden start to miss in that weird game scenario that I came up with? It's just that there is no tension because it is so determined.
I think there can be tension in a tactical game, but what you're missing there is sort of the sense of loss, maybe. Okay. I feel like there's a sense of loss in horror games where you're like, this is almost a body horror thing. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about DCC's magic system in that system, there's actually a lot of loss. And it's, you know, DCC gets a rep as like a very gonzo game.
Right.
But it wouldn't take much to play DCC in a very like grim, dark horror way.
Oh, yeah.
With no rule changes at all.
Yep.
If you were like looking at it as the story of a, you know, this poor fool who decided to like tamper with magic, and what happens as he goes out into the world and then slowly, like, you know, his body is like atrophied and hollowed out, and there's body horror like Cronenberg couldn't even imagine as, you know, limbs turn into crab claws. I mean, this is like The Fly, right?
Okay. Yep.
And so it's very easy to imagine that as sort of a body horror kind of inevitable. And in DCC, that is almost an inevitability when you use magic.
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, maybe DCC is a hidden horror game in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just that sort of like, and maybe that's part of its appeal to me. I don't know. But like that has all those components, right? There's like slow attrition. I think slow attrition is part of the horror games that we've been talking about in general.
Yep.
Right. It's certainly part of Call of Cthulhu with Sanity. It's certainly part of playing Dread. What, like every game that we've played, we've talked about that's successful with horror has slow attrition. So I would say slow attrition is not the only part of horror because it can become just tactics, like Jason was mentioning. It's a required component of a successful horror game.
And why do you think it is a required component? Like, what role does slow attrition play in making the game horrific?
Well, desperation has slow attrition, right? Because you know that like bad things are going to happen over the course of the act structure.
Yep.
Right. And I would say that what slow attrition does, first of all, it has to be stated. Everybody has to buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates that sense of anticipation, but you're not exactly sure when that penny is going to drop.
I could see that. Maybe for me, when I hear you say that, it makes me think that part of what that slow attrition does is, if we said a horror game is one where, you know, you don't have this agency where the goal is not to overcome the challenge. But if it becomes such a complete, like if I know in the moment as I'm playing each moment, if I know, oh, well, this is all going to end badly. This is all ending badly. Like I don't even have to think about it. I'm not holding my character close in a way that makes me afraid to lose it, because it's so determined and in my face. And whether it's what Jason said, which is only some of the characters die, or it's what Ethan said, which is this like slow drip and you don't know, is my time now? Is it now? Is it going to happen now? These all give you that little kernel of hope that says in the moment, even though I know, like Jason said at the beginning of Dread, I know I'm probably going to die, I'm still holding out that option that if I don't have that glimmer of hope, then I can't care about the fact that I'm going to die and I don't experience that same cathartic experience when I do die.
Before I pitched three subvariants of actual horror, let me pitch at least my three elements of a horror game.
Great.
Okay.
Based on this discussion. Element one is slow and inevitable. I think inevitable is probably the key modifier here. Slow, inevitable attrition. Two would be increasing constraint over the course of the game. And then three, the third factor would be the slim, perhaps, possibility of escape.
Yep. I think that...
Or success. I'm not sure what, you know.
Right.
I think that plus, the only thing I would add to that is that eventual demise, that lack of agency, that like... players, like, you're not going to ultimately overcome the challenge. If you, I think that feels really good to me, the, those four things.
Eventual. So that's, is eventual demise, though, in conflict with the idea of the possibility of escape? Like,
I know, I think it is. I struggle with this with every horror game that I run, and every horror game that I play in is like, you need to walk that fine balance where, like you said, where, or maybe I said, I don't know, that, that I need to be holding on to my character as I'm playing it. It's got to be precious to me. But at the end, the enjoyment I get is not about me trying to really overcome the challenge, because that's not what's going to happen. And if that's what I want to do when I play the game, I'm going to get frustrated like that chess player. And so on the one hand, I have to have some glimmer of hope, but then not experience it most of the time. Right. And that way I can hold it close and want to be lucky and be that one winning, but then feel that failure at the end and know that that's because it's a horror game. I can feel it without actually feeling like a failure. Right. I don't feel like I played badly. I feel like I played great.
All right. That feels like a pretty good overview and analysis of horror role-playing games. I certainly feel like I have more insight into them now. I liked kind of the breakdown of factors of horror games, as well as differentiating games that may present themselves as horror games, but I think are definitely not. They're either adventure games or tension games or scary games, but they're not necessarily horrific. One thing that I'm going to take away from this discussion besides that analysis is also the personal challenge of trying to use atmospherics better at the table to create those other factors, tension and scariness. Maybe I'll see if we can truly scare each other at a game in the near future.
I love it. That's definitely what I'm taking away from this as well, is we're all nerds who talk about this stuff all the time, but that limbic system, atmospherics, and the importance of it and why it allows horror in movies but it's so much harder in games. I think that's what I want to walk away with, is focusing on how do I make that happen?
Yeah. And I think for me, what I would just add to that is I think that I need to get better at using just verbal descriptions of all the atmospherics. Yeah. I forget what essay I was reading recently for which RPG, but it was describing how effective it is to use taste as an analogy for how something actually looks or feels or smells in the room. It might have been from the Alien RPG book. I can't remember. The idea was that that was something that, like, people immediately have like a little bit more of a revulsion, visceral kind of feeling towards.
Amen.
Than describing smell or sight. So, yeah, just getting better at descriptors.
Yeah, that was actually what my takeaway was today as well. I think a lot of these games are most successful when, you know, you can get people to think up the details for themselves. But how do you describe with a relative minimum of words the qualities of, you know, an RPG, you know, like the in-game space of an RPG, to give people the seeds to imagine the awful things on their own? And yeah, I think you know, using senses other than the visual ones to evoke that is something that I'm going to continue practicing. Well, that's it for this episode of RPG X-Ray. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us improve the show and reach more listeners who share our passion for role-playing games.
As always, we hope this episode has given you some new insights and ideas for your own table. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us on our website or social media channels, available in the show notes at rpgxray.com.
Thank you, guys.
That's a wrap. All right.
Right? All right. Excellent. Thank you, guys.
I have to go make breakfast for the kids, so okay. I will talk to you all soon. Yeah, I imagine. All right.